Star Wars Action News presents Republic Forces Radio Network, bringing you coverage of Star Wars, The Clone Wars. Our hosts will review the toys, books, comics, games, and all things related to the Clone Wars animated series. And after each new episode airs on Cartoon Network, our hosts will recap and review the show. And we want to hear your thoughts on The Clone Wars. Call us at 415-508-JEDI every Saturday after a new episode, and your call may be played on the air.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Republic Forces Radio Network. And once again, resuming our continuing coverage of all things Star Wars animated and back on track with the Clone Wars animated series every Friday evening on Cartoon Network. Back in the full swing of things with season four and our double episode release. And joining me tonight after a long hiatus is Arnie.
Hello, Republic Forces Radio Network listeners. I'm Arnie. If you don't remember, it has been a while. I wasn't able to join for the summer season, but I am co-host of Star Wars Action News, the Star Wars collecting podcast you can find at swactionnews.com, as well as Now Playing, the movie review podcast that's currently doing a Marvel series. Join us just this Tuesday as we review Daredevil as part of the Marvel Movie Retrospective Series at NowPlayingPodcast.com. Happy to be back talking Star Wars The Clone Wars with all you guys here at Republic Forces Radio Network.
And that, boys and girls, is why I didn't want to have Arnie and Nathan on the same call, because by the time all the plugs were over, it'd be time for the end credits.
Should I have just said hi?
No, that's for Barrett.
Hey, everybody, it's Barrett, your Swan Holocron Enhancer, and also your Marvelicious Toys Issue Enhancer.
And also with us is Jen.
Hey, guys, good to be back for the regular series.
And we are back for Season 4, and this is our 100th episode of Republic Forces Radio Network, including all four seasons of Clone Wars now. Two summer programming of the Droids and Micro Series, and a few specials from Comic-Con and Celebration, and a few special events. And it doesn't seem like it's been 100 episodes already, but lo and behold, here we are. Quite a milestone for us, isn't it?
It's absolutely amazing. You know, when we started Republic Forces Radio Network as the spinoff from Star Wars Action News, we never were sure what to expect, right? We still aren't sure what to expect. They're still being very cagey. There was the whole Clone Wars is going five seasons rumor, and, you know, 100 is the magical episode for TV shows to get into syndication, so you think Clone Wars is going to want to inch to 100, but when we started doing the summer programming and the con reports and things, it's just amazing how the show has grown and evolved from its original format, and Dan, I have to hand you a lot of the credit for the show becoming what it has. You've done a really great job steering this ship.
Well, thank you, Arnie. These guys do make it a lot of fun, and our listeners and the feedback that we get on the forums, on the Facebook, it makes it all worth it, because it's not so much like a job, more like, as has been said, it's just like sitting down with our friends. It's not really any kind of tedious task.
I am just so happy to be involved. You know, when Arnie asked me to be a regular host on the show, and, you know, because I had guest hosted a couple times, and when Arnie had asked me to be a regular host on the show, it was an honor. You know, we do it all for the listeners. I'm just glad it's 100 show, and I can't wait for the next 100. If the Clone Wars goes 10 seasons, like The Simpsons, then we'll be here forever.
Well, there's always two seasons of Ewoks.
Oh, goodness.
Yes, those
Nathan,
are all-
if you're listening, you can have my slot on that.
Well, I do want to say, you know, the show has evolved, and when I started off as the primary host, it was all of us getting to know each other, both as hosts and as the Clone Wars, getting to know the fans and the fans getting to know the Clone Wars. And then when I just couldn't handle as many podcasts as I was doing and Jerry stepped in, I think that he really started some great things that Dan has continued and then continued to improve upon.
Yeah, when I was selecting who was going to be in on this one, I went back and listened to all of our older shows, our season starters and closers, to see who all had been on one. And I did not remember at all that I was in on some of those really early episodes. Not the first one, but I think within the first three I was there. And then a few later, Barrett was in and Jen got in on quite a few. So we've been around for a long time on this, and it feels good to have taken it to 100. Looking forward, like Barrett said, maybe to the next 100.
And I just want to say that I think that out of the 100 episodes, my absolute favorite is when I got to hang with most of the hosts in person down at Celebration. And I am so looking forward to next August when we can do that again. And the one missing host will no longer be missing. Right, Barrett?
Yeah, we got our tickets. We've already booked our hotel, and we will be there.
All right, so we are here for the season premiere double episode of The Clone Wars. But before we get started in our discussion, let's kick things off with a brief plot summary. Episode 1 was Water Wars, and our fortune cookie was When Destiny Calls, the Chosen Have No Choice.
Water Wars! Tensions run high on the ocean world of Mon Calamari, where two separate peoples, the aggressive squid-like Quarren and their peaceful neighbor the Mon Calamari, struggle to maintain a fragile coexistence. Adding to this strife, the king of the Mon Calamari has been found mysteriously murdered, leaving his young son Prince Lee Char to guide his people alone. But the Quarren race will not accept the new ruler as their king. Senator Amidala and her Jedi bodyguard have arrived to help resolve the matter and to avoid plunging the planet into civil war.
We start the episode in the midst of a heated debate among the differing sides, which is only instigated further by the presence of the Separatist and Republic representatives. When things appear to be at an impasse, the Separatist representative gives his opinion.
It is my opinion the Quarren have no further business here.
It is clear there will be war. Anakin, Padme, and Captain Ackbar contact Yoda and Mace Windu, who promise to send reinforcements, including Kit Fisto, Ahsoka, and a company of clones to back up the Mon Cala against the forthcoming Quarren assault. Back beneath the waves of Mon Calamari, the Mon Cal senator has expressed instructions for Captain Ackbar.
I'm entrusting the safety of Prince Lee Char to your hands. You must remain at his side at all times as his personal bodyguard.
However, Captain Ackbar doesn't think he's quite up for the job.
With due respect, Senator, the prince is not ready to lead an army. He needs training.
Elsewhere, the Quarren are indeed preparing for an attack with the support of a large number of Separatist droids. In a call to Count Dooku, Riff reveals to us that this is all part of a Separatist plan. As the Mon Cal prince addresses his people, saying that he doesn't believe the Quarren will attack, they do. In a very thrilling battle, we see Ackbar and Anakin butt heads a bit about the prince's place amidst the battle. But in the end, he opts to stay among his people.
I have to stay here with my people. Press your attack, Captain.
When things look bleak for the Mon Cala, the reinforcements arrive, and the battle is won, if just barely.
Reinforcements! Finally!
However, this is not defeat for the Quarren. The Separatist commander has a secret weapon.
They are half machine, half monster. We call them Hydroid Medusas. They are invincible.
And apparently they are. Surprising how powerful cyborg jellyfish can be, isn't it? When the Quarren return, the Mon Cal and Republic forces are overrun, and even Ackbar thinks it might be a good idea to make a break for it.
There's a time to attack and a time to retreat, and now is not the time to be brave.
The safest place is in the caves.
I agree, Your Highness. Follow me.
So the few who remain either alive or not captured make a break for the caves as the Separatist leader reveals that the Quarren may have gotten themselves in deeper than they thought.
Then let's be thankful this is our day. A victorious day that...
Disobey a command from Count Dooku again, and I will kill you where you stand.
Yet in the midst of this terrible loss, Ackbar has some encouraging words for the young prince.
I wish I could have done more for my people. Maybe then we would have been spared all of this. The illusion that I could actually lead in my father's place.
Your father would be proud of you.
proud? We lost.
Today, you learn the hardest lesson a commander can learn. How to live to fight another day.
Episode 2 was Gungan Attack. And our fortune cookie for this episode was Only Through Fire Is a Strong Sword Forged.
A government toppled by civil war. Refusing to accept Prince Li Char as the next ruler of Mancala, the foreign people join the Separatist Alliance and launch an all-out attack on the Mon Calamari. Caught unprepared, the young prince and his Jedi protectors are quickly overwhelmed and forced to retreat into caves far below the capital city, leaving Count Dooku and his allies to plan their next move.
We find Dooku and Tamsin discussing the necessity of capturing the prince and what is to be done with the Mon Cal prisoners. The Quarren leader is shocked to find out the prisoners are to be slaves.
Surely you do not mean all of them. The women and children
are to be sent as well. Is that understood?
Yes, my lord.
The small band of those still not in Quarren custody attempt to contact the Jedi Council for help. However, they are barely able to establish the connection, and the transmission ends prematurely. Unsure of whether or not reinforcements are on the way, they decide to make an escape attempt for the Republic ship above the waves. Meanwhile, the Jedi Council is looking for suitable reinforcements, and since outfitting another group of clones will take too much time, the Council makes an unusual choice.
Naboo.
Yes, to the Gungans. We must look.
We shall contact them immediately.
Back on Mon Calamari, Anakin, the remaining Mon Cals, Senators, and Jedi make a run for their ship above the surface, just in time to see it explode. As the group descends with the remains of the ship, it is decided they will split up. Ahsoka, Kit, and the Prince together, and Anakin, Ackbar, and the Senators a different way. As the group splits up, Anakin and Ackbar express differing opinions as where hope for the future lies.
Our only hope is that Master Yoda can send help in time.
No, Prince Li Cha is our only hope.
The Jedi Council put in a call to Naboo, and after very little deliberation, it is decided that the Gungans will help Padme and the others.
Thinking times are done. We shall need to be leaving now.
Ahsoka and her group have found a safe place to hide, but from their concealment, they witness a terrible vision of the future for Mon Cala.
What you see, Prince, is the future of all the people on this world. Mon Cala and Quarren. All slaves for Count Dooku.
Meanwhile, Anakin has an idea to knock out the planetary sensors to prevent the detection of the reinforcements he is sure is coming. His plan is simple. Use the Force to rip down the entire building. Sure, that sounds simple enough. However, the loss of the radar and sonar makes it more definite in the Separatist's mind that reinforcements are definitely on the way. After a brief display by the Prince to reassure the Mon Cals that they have not been abandoned, help comes from the Gungans, and we get to hear Anakin say the four words we never thought we'd hear.
Perfect timing, Jar Jar.
Waza! Missa can't hear so good since we submerged by!
If only we could say the same thing, Jar Jar. Unfortunately, the Quarren and their allies are ready for this attack, and though the Quarren think they should withdraw, Riff has plans to thwart the attack. By using the Separatist craft as a blender, the sea is churned, and though Anakin is able to destroy the ship, the Jedi, escaping Mon Cals, Gungans, and Senators are captured, all except for Ahsoka and the Prince. And though he is eager to do whatever he can to free his people, Ahsoka has some advice for the Prince.
I know you're scared, but you can't let your fear control you.
Aren't you scared?
I used to be, all the time, until I realized that if you make decisions out of fear, you're more likely to be wrong.
I will unify Mon Cala again. I promise.
So our episode kicks right off with a lively discussion between the Quarrens and the Mon Cala, along with both sides' advisors, I guess you could call it. The Mon Cala have Padme Amidala and her personal bodyguard Jedi. We're still riding that train, are we, Anakin? And the Quarren have a Separatist whose name is Riff Tamsin, and he is a Karkaradon male who looks like a shark.
I'm gonna put on my nerd hat for a minute. Kakaradon is actually the Latin word for it's the genus name for a great white shark. So that was actually kind of clever of them. It means ragged tooth. So that was actually kind of clever of them because he looks like a great white. So I think that's probably where that derives from.
He looked so much like a great white, I thought he was going to eat Nemo.
But he didn't have an Australian accent, so.
I know, but I just expected him to go, Quarren are friends, not food.
I had a question about this because I didn't understand what either side was doing sending representatives, if this was a neutral planet, or what either side was doing sending representatives if it was controlled by the other. So I sent our Nathan P. a note on this, and he said that it is a factionalization. So either side would be free to send their representatives, which, while that makes it slightly less confusing, the Quarren were still letting this guy do all the talking.
It does seem odd, but you know what I was taken back to was, with my EU knowledge, the book The Approaching Storm by Alan Dean Foster, and how Obi-Wan and Anakin were sent to settle the border dispute on Ancyon, and how traditionally Jedis do get into the role of mediator many times. Well, here it was the Senate, not the Jedi, although Anakin was there as well. Given that they are allied with the Republic, and it appears that if the Quarren take over the world, the Quarren are going to secede, it definitely seems like something where Republic representation would be warranted. I was going with this, and I was kind of just rolling with it and bringing my EU baggage to explain it all away.
I like the fact that Anakin is still Padme's protector, because now, you know, it gives him the excuse to be around each other. You know, now it doesn't take the question. It takes the question away of why are they around each other all the time? But my question is, if Anakin is her protector, why is he making her jump out of a ship into the ocean about 20 feet above the ocean? Did you see that in the beginning where they both jump from the ship into the ocean? I'm like, wow, they must teach senators rock diving training in order to get to these places. But I like the fact that they're bringing it back from episode 2, where, you know, he was assigned to her to protect her, and he's continued to have that same assignment. You know, when she has to go out and do the Senate work. And I'm questioning, is this still Palpatine who's still controlling this? Because originally in episode 2, he's the one who suggests that Anakin takes Senator Amidala back to Naboo to protect her. So is he still, you know, working behind the scenes and still suggesting that Anakin still take care of her, you know, because ultimately he knows what's going to happen, or, you know, stuff is going as he has foreseen, you know. So it still kind of has, you know, the Emperor in the background, I think. He's still, you know, pushing buttons, making plans, still having Anakin next to the person that he cannot lose. And I really enjoyed that.
Now, Baron, I would be right there ready to agree with you on that if it wasn't for two of the episodes in previous season where, when Padme was in trouble or threatened and she ran off and had a Jedi protect her, it was Ahsoka.
Yes, yes. But you could argue the fact that Anakin can't lose Ahsoka or Padme, and if she was to lose both at the same time, that could progress him towards the dark side a lot faster. So that still could be in the realm of Palpatine, you know, pulling the strings in the background. You know, if it's not Anakin, it's Ahsoka, and he can't lose both. So, you know, all this is speculation, but I like the fact that they did that because, you know, it's all about using your imagination. You know, what's going on in the background? We're talking about it.
And to address the elephant in the room, as it were, one of the Mon Cala sitting in on this discussion is Captain Ackbar. Now, we've had a lot of original trilogy characters show up just for the sake of tying it in previous episodes. But this is one, at least I felt like in both of these episodes, Captain Ackbar's presence was pretty much warranted.
It didn't bother me. I thought it fit okay. It wasn't like Greedo where you had my head in my hands the entire time. But like, I felt like it fit. Like, we don't really know anything about Ackbar, and he had a military position in Return of the Jedi when we saw him. And he's in a military position here, and I feel like it worked. It didn't bother me.
I'm the one who's usually here going, why the hell did they mine this OT character to put him in a place he doesn't belong? But here, I feel he belongs just fine. It makes far more sense to me than even Chewbacca being in episode 3 and thus the Clone Wars. We know Ackbar wasn't young in Return of the Jedi. He was experienced. He was an admiral. We do have all this backstory from the EU, which we know the Clone Wars will feel free to overwrite as it wants, but from what I know of Ackbar, it made perfect sense, and I was really happy to see him here, and I love his portrayal. He's very dutiful, but also smart, and really liked him. He is a great counterpoint to me to seeing Tarkin in the Republic side.
And he's got a little gruffiness to him, doesn't he, that he doesn't show in episode 3. I mean, we all, in Return of the Jedi, we all know and we all like that Ackbar is a very smart and very brave individual. And here he shows him that he's still very smart. He's still very brave, but he's got a little chip on his shoulder, right? When the Kargadon kind of kicks dust into his face or bubbles into his face, you know, he wants to start a fight right there in the court. We had never seen anything like this. Like you said, Jen, we don't really know too much about Ackbar's background. And so to see how he has still a little chip on his shoulder and he's still learning to be the Ackbar that we all know and love. But at the same time, I had not ever thought of the Calamari ever being fierce warriors. I always kind of took him as being the smart people, you know, because when we see him in Return of the Jedi, he is the admiral. He's making the decisions. He's able to recognize the trap. But, you know, it's kind of cool to see where he comes from. He comes from a warrior culture. So it was nice to see a little backstory of the man we all know and love.
I have to say, I kind of disagree, Baron, depending on your familiarity and respect for the EU. We do know quite a bit about Ackbar. I mean, some of it is from semi-apocryphal sources, like those wonderful youth books, the Glove of Darth Vader series and all of that. But we have quite a bit of familiarity with Ackbar. Most of the time that we learn anything about his planet, we learn it as part of his backstory. So I think we know quite a bit, but so far it hasn't been stepped on in any way, which is something that I like. I like when they don't go out of their way to destroy what's come before.
But things break down rapidly in the Quarren, instigated by the Separatist representative, storm out, but not before one of the Quarren, which I'm guessing it was the Quarren leader, was really hard to tell because all the squid heads looked the same to me.
Speciest.
One of the Quarrens does say that he was the dead Mon Calamari King was his good friend, which kind of gives us a little glimmer of hope in the prince's eyes before all the Quarren leave. Anakin, Padme, and Captain Ackbar return to the Republic ship to report what has happened, and Mace and Yoda tell them that Kit, Ahsoka, and some clones will be there before the end of the day. So, Republic reinforcements will be there by the end of the day, but as we learn, it is not soon enough because the Quarren return to attack with the Aqua droids in their second appearance in the Clone Wars series, both in a season premiere.
Like they weren't hard enough to find on shelves already.
You know, now they'll have a new deco so they can re-release them.
What's the coincidence? I found two this weekend. At two different Toys R Us's, I found two different Aqua droids, and I have never seen them on the shelves before. And then we get the episode, so it's pretty cool. I wasn't quite sure. You know, there are slight changes. I wasn't quite sure. I know that concerning the Aqua droids, they have some hidden weapons that weren't there before. And there were also some slight changes with Kit Fisto. Did you guys notice the gills on his face? Did we have those gills before? I don't think we had the gills. But now he has gills.
Were they gills or were they just more prominent lines in his features? I didn't know.
Yes, they were moving.
Well, maybe this is the first time we've noticed him because it's the first time he's underwater.
Yeah, his gills were moving. He definitely looked like he was breathing in a couple of shots. It was actually pretty well done.
So the reinforcements arrive mid-battle, but it really doesn't seem to do all that much good except for give the Quarrens and the battle droids more people to kill and Tamsin people to show off killing, because that was kind of cool and very shark-like how he would just kind of rip into him.
I had a hard time with him, probably just because I'm a nerd when it comes to wildlife and stuff. He had his feet in a really weird position every time he would swim like a shark. It gave him this really cool movement, and he looked like a shark. But like, have you ever tried to swim like that? Because when I was a kid, I did, because I wanted to be a shark when I was a kid. And it doesn't work. You can't move that way. And it bothered me that they made him a biped and then tried to make him swim like a shark, because it kept throwing me out of the story. It's really nitpicky. It's really stupid, but it really bothered me. I wish they had given him like a tail or something instead, so he could have had his little shark moment and not offended my sense of anatomy.
But Jen, I noticed that too. And at first I thought, oh, they like make his feet turn sideways when he goes into his swimming position, which is kind of weird because your knees don't move back and forth like that as a biped. But then in the second episode, when we're kind of behind as they're approaching on an attack or something, and you see him swimming, he's actually kind of swimming side saddle. And I wonder what being would naturally progress to that state where you actually kind of turn your hips sideways to kick your feet just out of sheer obstinence rather than just kick them up and down. It's a little bit of an odd choice. I understand they did it to make him look more shark-like, but that was kind of an odd choice. So you're right. I agree.
I really like the way that he attacks. I mean, he doesn't use any weapons. He just uses the full force of his body to propel himself into an enemy and bites their head off or takes them, and they're screaming, you know, underneath. That was the best part, is he grabs a hold of one of the calamari, and they're just screaming for dear life, you know, just like if you were getting attacked by a great white shark. And I just kept asking myself, are the separatists making a super industrial toothpaste? Because he's just putting everything into his mouth. And I just want to tell my son, don't put that in your mouth. Don't put it in your mouth. But everything, everything's just going into his mouth. But the way he attacks, no weapons. He never used any weapons. He always just used the sheer might and force and of himself to attack. And I thought that was pretty cool, keeping with the shark, keeping with the great white shark. And
I didn't like it. And let me tell you why. You don't bring a knife to a gunfight, and you definitely don't bring your teeth to a gunfight. If he had been like a personified bayonet, and he was shooting people from afar, and if they happened to get within snapping distance, he bit, that would make tactical sense to me. But you just, I don't care how good a martial artist you are, you don't run into the middle of a war field where people are shooting at each other with your karate chops. And I think the same thing about shark biting. I think he needed a gun. And overall, I mean, I realize the Quarren are kind of based on squid, and you can kind of look and see aliens that are based on animals from Earth, but I find it to be the laziest type of sci-fi when you just have, like, a whale people and a squirrel people and whatever. And so it's just shark people. Yeah, and they attack like sharks. Yeah. It seems like lazy, lazy sci-fi.
Oh, Arnie, I couldn't disagree with you more. I think the reason that you bring a knife to a gunfight, it's because of the element is why it works. It's because they're underwater. It's because he can make these sharp movements like a fish, that he can dodge these things. You know, I agree. It would make sense if he was on land somewhere and, you know, bring a knife to a gunfight. But because he's in his element, it just made perfect sense for me for Count Dooku to send this guy. Because he is, you know, the great white shark out there is the most powerful hunter in you know, the most dangerous hunter in the ocean. And I thought it just made perfect sense that he would use his natural ability to his advantage. And I just thought it made perfect sense.
Using your natural ability is all fine if you're going up against other people's natural abilities. But if you're going up against their technology, you need to stay in the race.
In Avatar, they're using their natural ability against technology, and that's what you use. If you don't have the technology, then you have to use your natural ability. And sometimes the will and strength of an individual can overcome technology. I believe that.
That's apples and oranges, because the Na'vi and Avatar are no different than the Ewoks in Return of the Jedi, who still were armed. They were just armed with primitive weapons that they used to their advantage. But if you go out with no weapons, you're going to end up like that one sad little dead Ewok.
But his mouth is his weapon. That's his ultimate weapon. That's what he uses, his speed and his mouth. Those are his weapons.
My mouth is my weapon. It's not going to do me very good against a gun.
I really actually didn't care for it. I'm sorry, Barrett. I always picture like these people as people, and I'm imagining some guy on a battlefield running around biting people's throats out, and that would probably be a really big morale hurting thing to see for the opposite side, but I can't really buy it. I mean, it would probably freak the other army out, but I don't really see it working. I don't know.
That's the thing is, yeah, it would freak him out. If you happened to get that close, I would have loved it. But the fact that he wasn't carrying a gun, it's not a good method of warfare, especially if you're alone.
You know, it didn't really bother me one way or the other. On one hand, yes, it is unrealistic that he's swimming around in the middle of a laser fight, biting people. But yeah, I was just able to take it for what I'm sure they were trying to do. That, oh, look what's cool that this guy could do, that he's just so crazy he doesn't care and he's just out there.
Now, what about my statement about lazy sci-fi storytelling when you just take an Earth animal and make it an intelligent species? Do you guys agree with that? Disagree? I'm curious what your thoughts were, because it's just kind of an eye roller for me. It just seems very Smurfs.
That is a big science fiction trope. I mean, it seems like the easiest way to make aliens in a lot of science fiction franchises is to take an animal, even if it's kind of an uncommon, weird looking animal on Earth, and to make a whole people like that. So yeah, that is a little bit kind of, but on the other hand, is it really that out there? Well, it is kind of out there for Star Wars, because their races don't typically look like big versions of our animals a lot, with the exception of the squid head and the wolf man.
I mean, before the site redesign, StarWars.com actually had a whole article about lazy aliens, where I think it was Pablo Hidalgo himself calling out some of the laziness of this type of thing. And yes, the Quarren do look like squids, hence why his name was original Squidhead, but Mon Calamari don't look like personified calamari.
See, Mon Cal's always looked to me like personified koi fish, and the Quarren look like squids, and the Lurmen in the early seasons of Clone Wars look like lemurs, and we have little bears, which are the Ewoks, and it doesn't, like, things look similar, and I guess this guy, his behavior was too shark-like, maybe a little bit for people's taste, but the look of him, that didn't bother me at all. I can just chalk it up, he's a sea creature, maybe he just looks a lot like a shark, and he's a carnivore, so he's got a face full of teeth, so it didn't bother me. We've seen it so much that I don't feel like this guy really makes it a big problem.
I guess it was just his every mannerism was so shark-like. And, well, he didn't even look shark-inspired. He looked like somebody just put legs on a shark. It was like the Jaws ride flashbacks from Universal Studios.
It was totally Jaws, especially when he breaks Jaws 3, where they're in the tube. And I don't know, tell me if I'm jumping ahead, but when they're in the tube and he breaks through the tube with his face and... You know, that's totally Jaws, right? That's what Jaws does at the end of Jaws 3D. He breaks through the glass.
Oh, God, I will never be able to watch this episode again without hearing Lewis Gossett now. Thank you, Barrett.
Yeah, that did spring into my mind too, Barrett, is this was, that part was a little bit Jaws 3. But yes, that is jumping ahead, because that happened in the second episode. We still have to win and then lose in this episode. Which, speaking of which, the battle is sort of won amidst many casualties, and the Quarren's retreat merely to return with their super weapon, giant cyborg jellyfish.
Part machine, part monster. I thought it was going to be the Voltron Row Beast. I kid you not.
I thought it was at least going to be something. I mean, they called them the Hydroid Medusa. I'm like, oh, this is going to be something wicked. Nope, it's giant metal jellyfish. What in the world?
And surprisingly, they lost.
Exactly. They're not, how was it they put it?
This is what happens when you have engineers working on your warriors.
And to the point, who was controlling them? It wasn't very clear if the jellyfish machine monsters were sentient and they knew what to do, because they were just kind of dropped in the water. And we get a little background that they come from the Kakeradon's planet. They're the ultimate weapon there, but was there battle droids inside of those things that were controlling them? You know, they didn't seem to be getting any type of direction on who to attack. You know, how was the Quarren's not, you know, trusting that they weren't going to be attacked? And, you know, it wasn't very clear on why they were the super weapon. Were they super weapons just because they couldn't be, that the calamari didn't have anything to defend themselves with it? But they were just kind of floating around, and, you know, it didn't seem like they had any purpose there. They were just a big, pretty thing to put on the screen and kind of have another battle to waste a little time.
Try not to be super negative. I thought they were really dumb. I didn't really understand them, and I really didn't understand why they... I guess I could handle the Medusas themselves, because it's underwater, fine, they're evil. But first of all, I was confused as to how they can arc electricity in the water and without just frying everything in like a 10-foot radius. And secondly, I don't really understand what their purpose was as like war machines, because I feel like everybody was just kind of watching them until they got right on top of the army. And then they were like, whoa, we better probably shoot them now. It was actually more the tactics of this that really messed with me more than the actual jellyfish themselves. I feel like if they had been used in an interesting way, they could have been fine. But as it was, I didn't really see the point.
Yeah, I was right there with you on that one, Jen. I didn't understand. I thought maybe I'd missed something in that whole battle, why they were just kind of sitting there watching the pretty glowy things come at them until they were right on top of them, and then they couldn't get out of the way. Because it's not like these things drifted up and then when they got close, oh, then they started snatching people after. Nope, you looked like you pretty much had to touch them to get hurt by them, kind of like a real jellyfish. And I would have thought that maybe just getting out of the way in the first place would have really solved the whole problem there.
It really put a point on them waiting for the jellyfish to kind of float on top of them. That was just kind of a reoccurring theme of the bad planning that they were entrusting this new prince or whatever he was, this new leader. And I just never quite, you know, it got into the bigger thing where I just couldn't understand why Captain Ackbar and why Anakin and why Padme, who seemed to be all better leaders than this guy, why they would not just take over, because they just continued to follow him and continued to like prop him. It kind of reminded me of the spoiled kid, you know, who you really want to be something and do something with their life, but they've never really had a hard day's work in their life. So you just kind of keep propping them up when really you should just push them to the side and have somebody else come in. And I just could not understand traditions. They kept saying traditions, traditions, tradition, but why would they keep following this kid? And he's making the worst decisions ever. You know, he's not a tactician. You know, this is war. And even Anakin says that a couple times, you know, this is an unwise decision for you to stay here. And yet they continue to follow this character. And I'm hoping...
Barrett, you asked who you'd be arguing with tonight. Hi there. This is something I liked. I liked this about the episode because it was explained in a way that made sense to me. Because you and I may look at this and go, well, that's really stupid. Why don't they just take over? But it's understood that this is their tradition. You follow the prince's orders. And Ackbar, he knows what needs to be done, but he is so dutiful that he is not going to usurp the authority of their chosen ruler. He is not going to bypass tradition. And you talk about Anakin and Padme, and yeah, maybe Anakin would be better. Padme, I didn't see too good in a fight, but they are there to take over. They are there as observers and to support them, but it is not their place to take over. And Anakin does give quite a bit of advice, as does Ackbar. Ackbar, you know, says, go out there, make them cheer for you. They're pushing him in the right direction while maintaining respect for his authority. It's got to be a tough line for them to walk. And I got from the vocal performances that's the line they were walking. I really like that about this episode.
If it was a tough line to walk, it was a tough line to watch, because all I kept thinking is, why are they following this kid? You know, in dire situations, you have to adapt. And if your traditions are going to get me killed, you know, I may have to not follow those traditions. It just seemed that
Then that's a tradition that you don't respect, because, I mean, take it from a different, any standpoint. I mean, if you're out there and you are in the U.S. Army and you're dying to fight for the U.S. ideals, then you're putting tradition and your country and your people above yourself. And that's what Ackbar was doing. He was being military.
You have to adjust. And if your traditions are not the right traditions, you have to adjust. Anakin, even Padme, had been in more fighting situations And they can tell what's a good thing to do and what's not a good thing to do. Tacticians, they're tacticians. And I could not understand why they were still listening to this young, you know, this young whippersnapper who obviously doesn't believe in himself. For me, there's other ways that you could still prop this guy up and use him to rally the troops without following his plans that could get you killed.
I actually liked it too, because, I mean, you don't always make perfect decisions. There are lots of times where if you look back in history, you can go, wow, that was really stupid. And it's easy to say that from an observation, like a point of observation outside, whereas these people are invested in this situation. Akbar has these strong ideals, these strong morals, and this method of conduct that he has probably lived by his whole life. And these people don't see an alternative. This is the way they have to be. And to do otherwise would probably ruin what little credibility this prince had left. And so I thought it was okay. It was probably not the best choice. And it was kind of hard to watch them make bad choices, but you don't always make good choices. And it's interesting to see how they're working with this. That was one of the things in the episode I actually liked.
I guess I understand. I'm with you, Jen, completely. But something you said really crystallized it for me. And that is, they're making bad choices. And honestly, how many times have we been on Republic Forces Radio Network and harped about the characters making bad choices? But here they were making bad choices for a good reason. And I like that.
I really feel like this is a build. This is going to pay off in the culmination of this arc. We're going to see this kid have learned his lesson to be the leader that he wanted everyone to see him as. It's amazing. He's going to learn all this in 24, 48 hours of Akbar and fighting. But, you know, hey, it's a cartoon. What are you going to do? But we see him hesitating to make decisions that get his fellow Mon Calas captured or killed. And he sees at the end of this episode, or actually he doesn't see it in this episode. He sees the next episode where they're being led into slavery. And he sees things just keep getting worse because he's hesitating, because he's making these wrong decisions. And finally, he'll end up in hiding. And I feel that, and by that third episode, he's going to come out and he's going to be that firebrand behind his people. We're going to see him ending up the leader that his father was, or from what they tell us his father was.
I think that's said in the fortune cookie, right? I mean, he has to rise to the occasion.
I hope he goes out like Narveb in a blaze of glory. That's the only way that could redeem. That is the only way it can redeem it for me, is if he sacrifices himself for the good of his people and make himself a martyr. That's the only way it could redeem himself for me, for them following him and using his image, his sacrifice as a way to rally the troops. I mean, that really, honestly, for me.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to see it that way, but we'll see next week.
I'm with Dan. I mean, this is a kid's show. What we're seeing here is wish fulfillment for youths. This is a child who, when put under pressure, may have a little bit of problems rising to the occasion, but he will overcome because he is the relatable character for them in this. He's the main character. Anakin and Padme have basically been sidelined here, and same with the Jedi that come later. This is his story. I can't see him dying because, despite what you see, Barrett, I see what you're saying, but it's not like Narveb, because there he was giving in to the dark side and really going evil. This kid's doing his best. They're not going to kill him for trying.
So this battle ends with the Mon Calamari pretty much being routed, and the few, well, not the few, it's pretty much just, what, six or seven of them? The Senator, Captain Akbar, the Prince, along with Ahsoka, Padme, Anakin, and Kit Fisto, hiding in a cave, plotting their next move. And we find out from a conference call with the Separatist leaders and the Quarrens that the captured enemies are going to be taken into slavery, which is something that is from later in the Galactic Civil War, and in the EU, we've seen that the Mon Cal were an enslaved people. So that was kind of an interesting callback there. Whether it's the same state or not, probably not. I'm sure they'll be free just to be enslaved again by their own republic, but still interesting. All right, did anybody have any final thoughts on this episode before we get to Gungan attack?
as a season opener, I thought this one was par. You know, I just wasn't blown away the way I would like to be with the season opener, but I thought it had a lot of act. And the reason I wasn't blown away is because of the story we're being told. You know, last season, it seems like they start so many things with Savage Opress and all these other ongoing things. Because we're dealing with Captain Akbar, it was cool to see him there, but it just didn't suck me in for a whole season the way I'd hoped. I was glad that we were going on for a second half hour immediately. I just wanted to have a bit more there, but it was a good episode. I just felt a little let down by this being the premiere. This felt very episode 11 to me.
So our second episode was entitled Gungan Attack, and it's...
That sounds like something I'd need some Tums for.
Doesn't it, though? And it's Fortune Cookies, only through fire is a strong sword forged. But this episode starts off with the Jedi and senators and remaining Mon Calamari making an emergency call, a very distorted, interrupted emergency call to the Jedi Council, calling for help, in which neither side is really sure what the other side's saying. They do kind of get through that they do need some help, but they don't get a clear answer as to what that would be or even if that would be. So they decide to make a last run effort for their ship, which has been hovering above the water, apparently. How's that work out? What I mean is, didn't they realize things were going to crap beneath them under the water and, I don't know, go for help? Nothing?
I hadn't thought of it, but you make a very good point.
But maybe that's part of the reason why they couldn't, because once everybody gets close, the ship explodes and they go right back down by hanging onto the debris. They make it a quick decision to split up their separate ways, and the hunt for them, I guess, ensues with the main goal being to capture the prince by the separatists. Really, this is all just paving the way for the big part of this episode. And I know it's what we really all want to talk to. When they can't find any quicker reinforcements, they decide to call the Gungans.
Because it worked out so well for Naboo.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, you mean in episode one? Yes.
Because didn't the Gungans lose? Didn't the Gungans lose in Naboo in that fight?
Yeah.
If it hadn't been for Anakin and the one starfighter, wouldn't it have all gone to hell?
I think this is all... Every time they throw the Gungans into a fight, it is thinly veiled genocide. They are trying to wipe them off the face of the planet.
You mean Palpatine still wiped them out this time? All of them.
All of them.
Exactly right.
You know, this is going to be the most weirdest Republic Forces radio, because I could not disagree with you more. I thought it made perfect sense that they would get the Gungans, and I cannot believe I'm defending the Gungans, okay? I can't believe I'm defending them, but for me, it made perfect sense. You've already have good relations with the Gungans. We have good relations with the Gungans. They were willing to put themselves out in front on the front lines in the Phantom Menace just so we could go in there and retake the palace. You know, they're willing to sacrifice. They're very brave, you know, very stupid.
So that's why when they get the call, they're like, Musa needn't think about this.
Very stupid. You know, let me finish. They're very stupid, but they're very brave warriors. And I thought it made perfect sense. Who would you get in a time of need? First of all, why are they only outfitted one garrison of clones or whatever they get? You know, why didn't they have a backup plan? And they figured that, you know, if this goes down, we'll have somebody. Why they didn't have that is beyond me. But for them to get the Gungans, they are warriors. And, you know, when they come across the monster jellyfish, I thought, wow, who else would you want to send against them than the Gungans? Because in The Phantom Menace, we see that when they go through the center of the planet, they have these huge fish that are always, you know, always around the Gungans at all times. So they have to be prepared to deal with these huge monsters all the time. So it made perfect sense that they would send in the Gungans to deal with these huge jellyfish monsters. And I thought it was perfect.
Barrett, first of all, going back to the episode one thing, is it really a good relations matter, or is it really, let's look at it like this. If Natalie Portman and Keira Knightley asked you to do something, are you going to say no? Think about that. Okay. Secondly, yeah, they didn't fight the creatures in the center of Naboo with boomers. And that's what they were throwing at these giant jellyfish. They were taking them out with the boomers. So
even my point is, go ahead, make your third point.
I think that's why I made two and three all together. it's silly. I'm sticking with my, they're really trying to kill all the Gungans because they weren't even nice enough to get closer to the water like they were with the clones. They made them jump from a pretty high up. They just, get out here. This is your stop. And they go.
My point is that the Gungans have the means to take care of these huge monsters. They have them in the Phantom Menace. They're those huge, big monsters. Always a bigger monster, is what Qui-Gon says.
Bigger fish.
And they have. There's always a bigger fish.
And they're not electric jellyfish.
Yes. Well, but it goes along the same lines that there's these huge, insurmountable monsters out there that are all around the Gungans in their homeworld, and they have to have the means to deal with them. And it made perfect sense that you would take these guys who we've already established, you know, who have good relations, and to fight these big monsters. And I just can't believe that you guys are not siding with me on this. I thought for sure this would be the only thing that made sense in the second episode would be the Gungans coming in because they're water warriors.
Here's the thing. It makes sense in a bad cartoon logic kind of way that we need somebody to fight in water. So let's pull out that species we had that fights in water. I don't understand why they had this Gungan leader who is not Boss Nass. And him going, Misa, I have to think about this. Just giving Jar Jar, who was that Ahmed Best? I thought it was, but.
Yes, it was. Actually, both of them were Ahmed Best.
Oh, he was arguing with himself. But it gave Jar Jar the impassioned, she's a would do that for you. She's a did do that for you speech. And I don't understand. He's like, Misa, done thinking. Weeza go. Why did we even need that scene?
Listen, I'm not defending the talk. Okay, I cannot stand the way the Gungans talk, the Dumgans talk. But we needed that scene because we needed Jar Jar. We needed Jar Jar. Jar Jar is the one we all know and love, you know, and we needed Jar Jar to be there to tip the scales in the Republic's favor. So I think.
Because when you have a super strong shark creature that's eating you, we need Jar Jar. This is what you're saying. Just want to make sure we're on the same page.
Yeah, Barrett, you're it's like you've had a stroke. You're saying words that just don't make sense. We needed Jar Jar. I don't understand.
You think that it's not the light isn't dawning on me what I'm saying? I can't believe I'm defending them myself. But to me, I like that. That was my favorite part of this episode is when the Gungans and when they were jumping out the ship, I really wanted one of them to go, yippee, and jump out backwards and do the flips. And I was so surprised when they didn't put that in because the Gungans are like the soldiers that really don't know what they're getting into, you know, but they're so brave. You know, they never say no to a fight. And you got to respect that. You know, they might not be the smartest species out there in the galaxy, but they're surely the bravest. They know that they're going up against insurmountable odds and they're fighting for their friends. And I got to respect that.
Well, I could have accepted that. I could accept that they were what they had and they had to send them in and they just won by stupid accident. If they had handled it that they won by stupid accident, instead these things jump into the water and they're throwing boomers around. How did they know that those were the one thing that would hurt these giant robot jellyfish? I mean, the last episode they told us that the guy touted they're impenetrable to all known weapons or whatever, something like that. And they just come in. That's what they're throwing. It's like, at no point in the call did Anakin say, oh, by the way, they've got giant robot jellyfish and we can't kill them. They just knew. And the Gungans just knew that. Oh, and they can't hear underwater, too, by the way. That was weird.
Well, that's what they have. That's what the Gungans have. That's what their weapons are. They got the Boombas. You know, maybe they didn't know that they were going to work, but that didn't stop their bravery and their mission from going in and they're helping their friends. You know, and just so happens that the Boombas did work. And you could go back to what I said earlier, that maybe they developed the Boomba, and that's the only thing they have to use because they are always defending themselves from these huge monstrous sea creatures, and they found out that the Boombas work. You know,
maybe that's my issue. is I was taking Boom as more of a anti-machine defense because I thought that they were like bubbleized electricity. Maybe that's my issue here, Barrett.
My question is, I was really under the impression that the Gungans couldn't breathe underwater, and this really messed with my head because their city, yes, it's underwater, but it's in a little like a bubble dome thingy, and they're in air, and I was really confused because I thought they were like ducks where they could just hold their breath for a while maybe, and they never had to go up for air, so I just thought that was a very weird choice as opposed to another fish people.
I had the same thought, Jen. And what occurred to me, though, with the Blu-rays coming out, I just watched The Phantom Menace over the weekend, and Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon needed their rebreathers underwater, and Jar Jar just went. And was he holding his breath, or is he an amphibian? It's never really said, so I'm now taking it they're amphibious. Listen, according to Wikipedia, which, because StarWars.com now references it, we know it's the Bible, they're amphibians.
And Barrett, I've gone and looked at Wikipedia too, and you're right. That's what they use for everything. The mysterious blue white energy goo that is mined in the depths of Naboo's oceans. That is their power source and the basis of their weaponry as well. So the Gungans show up and they help for a time, but in the end, Riff Tanson decides to turn on his big blender. And that changes the tide of the battle again back into the Quarren's favor. Now, that was a little bit dumb. I think I'm going to go with dumb, really. I'm going to take my submarine and make it spin around in a circle and make the ocean a big blender to beat you.
You're not going to get any arguments from me.
I guess this episode kind of started down the what the crap is going on path when the Gungans showed up, and from there on out, it's just...
It's still better so far than Gungan Jedi.
Well...
Bombad Jedi.
Man, you guys are going to kill me. I thought it made perfect sense. I mean, how else would you take control of the whole environment unless you turn those into, you know, the spinners? You know, I thought that was perfect. That was the way how you take control of the everything. You know, if you're in control of these big, huge machines that can spin the water, you know, and disrupt the fight and basically being able to single out the prince, you know, I thought it was brilliant. I thought it worked. I mean, it's in the water. That's what you have to do. You know, you whirlpools and stuff like that. That's what you have to do in order to control the environment. And how else are you going to control that big environment without changing it somehow? And I thought it worked.
But you're on a whole world that's water and you've got one blender going.
It was several of them that was doing it. It was one at a time, but no, it was several of them.
It seemed very Wile E. Coyote.
Yeah, it was... Something.
I thought, how else would you take control of the whole environment without making it into a big whirlpool? And
Barrett, I am so glad that I'm not with you while I'm hunting that Roadrunner, because you're going to be like, how else are we going to do this without the Acme rocket strapped to our back?
Well, it wasn't the only, you know, it does not seem like Riff Tamsin is a very good tactician, because you know, at first he tries to use the jellyfish, and now he tries to use the whirlpool thing, and neither one of them seemed to work very well for him. You know, they seem to be game changers, you know, where they change the game. Right?
That's what a game changer is, yes.
But they don't seem to work very well, you know, but they seem to be kind of good ideas, you know, and I just think the environment, changing the environment to your advantage. And the one way to do it was the whirlpool. And I thought it worked.
So the blenders apparently work because the Gungans and what's left of the Mon Cal are reduced to, and the Jedi, are reduced to prisoners. And the only free folk are the Prince and Ahsoka. Once again, two teenagers running around. Crazy stuff.
I was starting to lose interest at this point. I'm going to be perfectly honest. I'm like, okay, I feel like we just saw this 20 minutes ago. It seemed like a bad choice of episodes to put back to back when they do the same thing.
It was a little odd that they basically had the same thing happen twice, just with different reinforcements and they call the herd further. Makes you wonder if the next one, there's going to be a few reinforcements and everybody will be dead. And we know that's not going to happen. So obviously it has to turn around, but I guess third time's a charm. Anybody else have any feelings on how this episode wrapped up, or are we ready to discuss the bit preview we got?
Not about the ending, but we haven't talked about this at all. I thought the visuals for this episode were great. Plot problems aside, like just visually the rendering and the way they modeled the water and the effects of the water and Kit Fisto's headtails in the currents and everything. I thought this was really beautifully done, and I just want to put that out there.
I'm right there with you, Jen. Gorgeous looking episode. Just absolutely beautiful. I've complained on the show before. Sometime in the past few months, we actually started getting Clone Wars in high def now. And this episode, just gorgeous all around. They've just done so well with the animation on the show.
You know, after taking part and being in the rendering panel at this year's San Diego Comic-Con 2011, and hearing Mr. Filoni talk about the rendering and how he's going to make things work and how he was trying to fake water by making bubbles and stuff like that. And, you know, underwater, there's not a lot of light, you know, and a lot of these scenes were, you know, had a lot to do with a lot of shadowing in the right places and the light, you know, hitting the characters just at the right spot in order to illuminate the characters. And, you know, it could not have been very easy to take this dark, deep, cold underwater world and make it vibrant. You know, and so I have to agree with you guys. Kudos to Mr. Filoni and his animators, because nothing was very blurry. You were able to see everything. You were able to even tell the different colorations of the Mon Cal, from the prince being a golden kind of color to the senator, the Mon Calamari senator, you know, having the different markings on her skin, to Captain Ackbar with his goatee. You know, his braided goatee or whatever that is underneath his chin. You know, so I was able to identify different characters very easily without having to say, is that, you know, because they all looked pretty similar, you know, but the way that they did it, I was able to recognize each character without any difficulty. And that could not have been an easy task. So my hat goes off as well.
Yeah, visually, this was an awesome episode. There's one scene that was my, oh crap, that looks awesome moment in this episode. I can still see it very clearly in my mind, is when the Republic cruiser is coming through the clouds. I can't remember if it was the first episode or the second episode. I think it was probably the second. But at that point, I was like, wow, they really are, storytelling aside, they're really doing great things with the visuals this season. We are, once again, just taking it up a notch. So visually, this was an awesome episode. Now we do have a continuity corner from our own Nathan P. Butler, who, though he couldn't be with us on the call tonight, he is going to be letting us know what changes this brings to the continuity. Nathan?
Hello, fellow panelists, and of course, listeners out in fandom land. Before we get into the episodes this week, let me quickly note that with the new revamping of StarWars.com, that quite frankly has removed a lot of its best content and turned it into a sort of video clip hub or PBS Kids version of Star Wars, the episode guides for The Clone Wars have changed format from being true episode guides like they were before into basically pages that just have a quick description of the episode and links to related entries in the woefully light encyclopedia that has replaced the databank, or, worse yet, fan sites like Wikipedia. Hey, don't get me wrong, Wikipedia can be great. But it is a fan site, not a place for official Star Wars information, so frankly not a viable replacement for the databank when it comes to official data being provided to fans. We won't be getting much behind-the-scenes info on these episodes, it seems, thanks to the change in the episode guides, at least compared to previous seasons. Frankly, that means there won't be a lot of those odd little insights provided to us that you'll find in these Continuity Corner recaps of that information. We should also keep in mind that the story behind these episodes isn't the usual stuff that happens off-screen that we just have to accept, as it often is in the series. Instead, the lead-in to Water War takes place in the Clone Wars Adventures children's MMO adventure, Mission on Iceberg 3. The Jedi are called to the planet to deal with a separatist incursion under General Grievous. Upon arriving to assist King Yas Kalina, who is the 82nd monarch of the planet, by the way, the Jedi are only marginally successful, as Kalina is assassinated. This is the recent royal death that Water War refers back to and sets the stage for the surprise ascension of Prince Li Char to power. So let's move into the episodes themselves. This week, Water War and Gungan Attack bring us a new writer for episodes of The Clone Wars, Jose Molina. They also bring in a few new voice actors to the series, Art Butler, no relation, as Ackbar, Adam MacArthur as Li Char, and Gary Anthony Williams as Riff Tamson. Among the other minor characters, we actually see Ahmed Best playing not just Jar Jar Binks, but also Boss Leone. Corey Burton also does double duty as Count Dooku and Quarren leader Nosori. Get it? No sorry? Not sorry? I hope that was an intentional pun, not just an accident of naming. Speaking of Riff Tamson, he is a new character, said to be a Karkarodon, K-A-R-K-A-R-O-D-O-N, from the planet Karkaris. Both of which, the planet and the species, are new. The hydroid Medusas that the species develops for the Separatists and uses here are also new. Li Char was created for the series, but was noted in the Clone Wars Avengers MMO's aforementioned storyline previously. He and his people also bring us a new name for the planet on which the battle takes place. Known previously as Mon Calamari and as Dak, the planet now has a third name, Mon Cala, which might be a formal name, or might just be a nickname for Mon Calamari, like Mike for Michael, and the like. We also may be getting a new capital city for the planet here, as this is unlikely to be Coral City, New Coral City, or any of the other capitals or major urban centers we've seen for the planet thus far. This appears to be another new Lucas creation. Kit Fisto returns here, which appears to be his and the Clone Wars' second battle on Mon Calamari. Given that the one from the Genndy Tartakovsky micro-series was set within the first year of the war, and this one takes place after Ahsoka's model change that puts it likely into 20 BBY, rather than the 21 BBY from what seems to be an erroneous entry in a UK Star Wars book from Pedigree, Star Wars Annual 2011, it would seem that both of the battles in the Tartakovsky series and this series do exist independently. Then again, with chronology in flux during the era of the Clone Wars already, who knows how this is going to turn out? For what it's worth, it would at least appear at the moment that this new battle on Mon Cala does not overwrite the previous one, but is instead a separate, broader encounter. Speaking of overriding previous continuity, or not in the previous case, we have another instance of a leader on Naboo being changed by this series. You may recall that we originally had been given the impression by the expanded universe and the films themselves that Padme was succeeded by Queen Jamilia, then by Queen Apelana in Theed, only to learn of the existence of Queen Niyutni when Lucas created that new queen for Season 1 of The Clone Wars. The same can now be said of the Gungans from Naboo, as we had Boss Rugor Nass in charge in The Phantom Menace, and in pretty much all related EU materials after that, and had assumed him to still be Boss when attending Padme's funeral in Revenge of the Sith. Here, however, we see a new Boss in his place, Leone. This not only affects the older EU, but also the newer EU that ties directly into the cartoon series, as the webcomics from Season 1 featured Boss Nass in charge at least as of the beginning of the war in the webcomic The Valley that tied into the episode Blue Shadow Virus. How this will be worked out in retrospect, or in retcons as it were, is unknown at this time. Speaking of changes in leadership, we have previously seen Senator Mina Tills, the Mon Calamari senator, in Revenge of the Sith and its novelization, and even in previous reference material. However, the previously male senator is now a female in the cartoon series. Whether this was a Lucas change or a change by the production team that now contradicts Lucas's original vision of the character is currently unknown. My guess would be that they'll stick with the female version of the character from here on in, as the character had only a tiny, minor role in other previous appearances. The biggest questions of the episode, though, seem to come from the appearance of Ackbar and how that might fit in with the rest of his previous backstory. Honestly, though, this seems to be pretty smooth sailing for Ackbar, if you'll pardon the nautical pun there. We know that Ackbar is part of the Calamarian Council during the Clone Wars, and even the leader of the Council by the era of Revenge of the Sith. We know that he was among those trying to negotiate with the Empire shortly thereafter when the world was taken over, leading to his enslavement. We also know that he would eventually be saved from enslavement to Wilhuff Tarkin by the fledgling Rebel Alliance and participate in Rebel activities after that point, becoming the Rebel hero he's remembered to have been. During the Clone Wars era itself, though, we don't have a ton of prior information on the character. As long as the Calamarian Council, which appeared in the Genndy Tartakovsky series and elsewhere, isn't totally wiped from existence by the very notion of a king for Mon Cala, which isn't necessarily the case given how constitutional monarchies in the real world have often included a monarch alongside some sort of legislature, I think Ackbar's inclusion is pretty uneventful from a continuity standpoint. We'll see how this participation bears out as we move toward the final act in this three-part story arc next week. And on that quasi-cliffhanger for Continuity Corner, we'll wrap up the Continuity Corner for this cliffhanger from the Clone Wars. Dan?
All right. Thank you, Nathan. Now, we did have a few voicemails.
This is Glenn, occasionally Dooku on the forum, calling in on the premiere of Season 4. Really, my only thing that I could complain about this episode would be the fact that in many of the scenes, it seems to be sort of, to do an underwater episode, they did it by sort of ignoring that they were underwater. And, like, one thing would be, like, the hologram, like, generator working underwater. And, of course, we had the lightsabers, which I'm not saying that the lightsabers can't work underwater, but they think they would be, like, boiling in the water or something as they move through. There'd be some weird effects of doing things underwater, even perhaps even talking and communicating underwater. Seemed to sort of mostly just ignored that. Although the jet propulsion, you see like bubbles and things like that. So it's weird. They sort of go back and forth with what something they show, something they don't. But otherwise, I mean, the visually it was good. The story is pretty good. First time I saw it, I missed sort of the narrator part on my recording at home, and just watching now. And it seems they dropped the part about the mysterious death of the king and sort of looking into that. So hopefully that'll be something that'll be explored in next week's episode. But look forward to hearing what your thoughts are, and good luck. Bye.
You know, he's absolutely right. We've already established that the lightsabers could work underwater.
How is that handled underwater? And I know that they've thrown out different explanations. Kit Fisto's lightsaber is built different. That's why it works underwater, things like that. But that's not really something that they kind of went into it. I guess it's kind of, I mean, they could spend 22 minutes telling us how the technology works underwater. They could try to tell us the story. So I guess I'm glad that they went with that.
Well, a question, is a lightsaber hot or is it just giving off energy? Because I never really understood that. You know, is it hot? Because I know when you're cutting through metal, you know, it kind of melts the metal, but that could just be an energy transfer because, you know, it makes sense that it's not hot because you would not be able to hold that up to your face very close if it was giving off too much heat.
But it's a blade of pure plasma. I don't know what that means.
Jen, exactly. Is plasma hot?
Plasma can mean anything. It's just like techno babble term, so I don't know.
Yeah.
Hi, guys. This is Matt from Orlando. Yesterday's episode was really great. The graphics, I noticed they were much better than before. Like each season, they get a graphics upgrade. The shark guy, he was pretty cool, even though he's a kind of a total jerk personality-wise. But he kicked butt and he wasn't incompetent, and he did seem a little violent, which didn't bother me, but I thought about the kids and how you guys talk about, you know, which way they're going with making it more violent or less. But he was pretty cool. I just hope they don't, like, kill him off, you know, after the story arc or turn him into kind of like an incompetent guy, like, unfortunately, they do with Grievous, but which I hope Grievous gets some better episodes soon, too. But he was pretty cool overall. And Jar Jar, it seemed like he had Jedi mind trick ability there when that Gungan leader was talking to Yoda. The Gungan leader was, he didn't feel like he could do anything now. He didn't think they could help out. But then Jar Jar yells at him, and all of a sudden he's like, we need to go now. And that was kind of funny. And then I thought the Jedi were really great. Anakin destroying that squid sub, and Ahsoka was kicking butt with her two lightsabers, and Kit, I thought it was pretty cool they had Kit there because he's so awesome underwater and he could use his underwater swimming ability to enhance his fighting and everything. So I give the show A+ overall, and your guys' show is really awesome. I enjoy listening to it as much as I enjoy watching the Clone Wars show. So I hope you guys have a great weekend and can't wait to hear what you guys think. Goodbye.
You make a good point about the action in this episode. We didn't kind of talk about that. There was a lot of it. My favorite fight was the one where Anakin loses his helmet and it's going down in the depths and he's still fighting, but also fighting for air, and Ahsoka swims down there and catches the helmet. Although that was the one place I thought the animation kind of got spotty because she just didn't seem quite within grasp of the helmet. I'm like, did she miss the helmet? Oh, wait, no, she has the helmet.
Yeah, that was kind of an interesting forced grab on her part. But yes, the action was great. To your point about whether or not the shark guy was a little bit too intense for kids, I kind of was wondering that myself. I'm like, this is pretty graphic because he's not just killing clones in their armor. He was biting through the necks and the head area of Mon Cals. So that was a little bit more graphic, but I think as we kind of started to establish last season, they're kind of going a little more with the kind of higher, the older age range with the violence. I think we all know that this is not meant for the SpongeBob SquarePants crowd anymore.
I don't know. We had sharks and squid and calamari. I was expecting a sea anemone.
You know, my son and I watched this together, and he loved the shark. He loved it. He really loved it when the Kakaradon busted his head through the tube and was kind of roaring with his, you know, he's really shark-like then. And my son was like, whoa! So he really liked that character. And I think the shark character is so much different than any other character we've seen so far. I mean, you know, we have these great characters like Moma and Don and stuff with these beautiful heads and, you know, really alien-like. But I think the shark character for him was something that he could recognize that was really cool. I mean, I don't know what kid, 6-7-year-old kid, doesn't think a great white shark is really cool. So,
hey, Fernando Vieira here, and I just finished watching this Star Wars season 4 premiere, and oh my god, I gotta say, the animation, first of all, the animation has seriously improved a lot since the beginning of season 1 until now, the premiere of season 4. You can definitely notice all the changes in animation, how it's improved, how it's so much better, and it's just wow. And the episodes, especially like the villain, the Separatist villain that looks like a shark. I can't remember his name, but he was very ferocious and like bites off the Mon Calamari. Yeah, it was really, really well done. And I love how they added Admiral Akbar in this episode. That was really cool. And boy, did part 2 end in such a cliffhanger. Like, got Kit Fisto captured, and whatever happened to Anakin and Padme disappeared. So I guess we'll find out in the next on Friday, next Friday. So can't wait for that. And I can't wait for this season. Pretty sure we're going to see a lot of new things this season. Maybe some Darth Maul stuff later on. It's just going to be the best season yet. And, yeah, I'll call again next Friday. So, yep, I hope the season will be the best season yet. So, see ya.
You know, that was something I noticed in the trailer, is we don't see any Savage Opress, do we?
No. Not yet, but they did that last time. Last season, they did it every season. Well, they only show us a little bit, but then halfway through, we'll see Savage, and the big guns will come out. I really believe that the what we're seeing now is only going to be about halfway through the season, and they're going to have a whole bunch of new previews for the rest of the season, the second half.
Hi, everyone. It's Robert Darth Akari calling in with my thoughts for the Clone Wars season premiere. It seemed like a bit of a mixed bag for me. Graphically, very good. And actually, I was a little bit surprised in a way by the way that the episode ended. I knew it was part of a three-parter and everything else, but I was kind of already starting to get a little wary of the plot, but I was kind of surprised it went as dark as they did with the storyline. A couple things that kind of stuck with me, though. Not entirely fond of the Hydra, Medusa, giant jellyfish weapons. I mean, they seemed like, yeah, they just kind of showed up and looked imposing, but yeah, they zapped a few clone troopers, but they didn't actually do all that much, other than just sort of float around and make some noise. Battle sequences, surprisingly intense. I mean, with the whole shark guy, I can't think of his name right now. But like the new character models, it was kind of nice to see that they added in Mina Tiaris, you know, the Mon Cal senator. It took my brain a couple seconds to realize that's actually a character that appeared in the movie. So I was like, wow. At first I was thinking, okay, there's a separatist plant or something like that. budget, printing out the data. I remember she was actually in a few of the background scenes. There's even an action figure of that one. Gungans still kind of bug me a bit. The whole, we've got to talk about it, time for action. Okay, yeah, we're not going to talk about it. Let's just go. But it was kind of nice that the Republic thought on their feet and said, you know what, you know, hey, let's just grab another underwater army. And the handiest one around happens to be the, you know, the Gungans. Although, seeing what we've seen in the trailer for this season, it kind of makes me wonder now if we might see a continuing storyline. Because we've already seen General Grievous, you know, going around taking on Gungans. So it kind of makes me wonder if, you know, when we get our eventual Republic victory that we're going to get here with the Mon Cal arc, if we're going to end up seeing the Separatists say, okay, you ended up foiling our plot there, so we're going to take the fight to you next. Which, that could be interesting if they actually go in that direction. Otherwise, I'll be looking forward to seeing what happens next week, and always enjoying your show. Have fun, guys, and talk to you soon. Bye.
I had wondered that myself because, you know, this is going to wrap up the next one. And, you know, they're not going to end it on a, well, everybody lost and everybody died. And we know that at some point Grievous is going to Naboo and fighting Gungans. So I wondered if it was going to be backlash from their assistance here and they're going to get taught a lesson about meddling. But as far as the preview goes, now, I think we did, some of us saw different ones because I did not watch this myself on Cartoon Network. And so, Jen and Baron, you guys have said that the preview you saw was more of a what's coming the rest of the season preview.
That's correct, Rockstar. I did not see apparently the same preview you saw. What I saw was just basically a amalgam of the different previews that they've already basically shown us on StarWars.com. The only difference I saw was basically showing that Anakin is kind of turning more to the dark side. I don't remember seeing that in the previous previews, but it's kind of surprised me because I was very adamant when I first started doing this with you guys that they probably were not going to show Anakin too much delving into the dark side. It's more of going to be his, you know, I just assumed it was going to be more of him being the hero in the Clone Wars. And we will see the downfall, you know, in episode 3. But I'm kind of surprised and actually looking forward to seeing him balancing, you know, walking that rope between good and evil. So as far as that preview, it didn't have anything to do with the next episode coming up, but just what's coming on down the line.
Here's the thing. I know that's what the trailer was telling us this was about. Is about keeping an eye on Anakin and things, but yet, haven't we seen that many times before where they show us a trailer where there's like one line by Obi-Wan about being concerned about Anakin, and then they play the Imperial March, and then we see Anakin with a lightsaber, and we think he's going dark, and then when we actually see the episode, he was just being heroic. So, even though that's what the trailer says, I'm not holding my breath for that arc to occur here. I don't even see how it could make sense to occur here. But there's a lot in this trailer that got me really excited, too.
You're right, Arnie. The only time that I can remember where that actually paid off was when they was Holocron Heist, where they captured Cad Bane and Anakin used his dark side power to try to force, you know, I can make you. And I think they kind of showed us that in the preview of him doing that and Ahsoka kind of looking scared. And I think that was the only time it paid off, so... You know, I'm hoping.
I mean, even when we saw Darkseid Ahsoka, I knew beforehand she was going to be possessed by something, and she was.
I thought there were a few moments where they have Ahsoka kind of... There are a couple shots where Anakin's igniting his lightsaber or charging off of his lightsaber, and they have Ahsoka kind of give him this sidelong glance, like, ooh, maybe this isn't so great. So I thought maybe they're going to push that a little bit more than they have in previous seasons, but I'm always a little bit skeptical of these mishmash trailers just because they do kind of skew them, but I thought from the footage that they showed us it might be legit this time.
It's possible. I mean, I'm not going to say they won't absolutely. It just, I've just been, you know, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. Fool me three times, well, that's still on me, I guess. Fool me four times and you're the Clone Wars. But there was some really, really cool stuff in here. I freeze-framed this trailer and went frame by frame through it. And we see some kind of, like, jackal-looking creature with a light whip. And it's very cool to see, you know, Luminaya's light whip brought to life in the Clone Wars. We see Grievous squaring off against Asajj Ventress, four sabers versus two. A six lightsaber fight between two people. I am very looking forward to that. We see somebody who's Darth Maul dose because he's got two double-ended lightsabers and yet he still somehow doesn't cut himself off at the ankles.
Yeah, and he's Dexter Dexter's race, so he's got four arms in that mix too. Not really sure how you...
Maybe not when he's done.
Quite possibly not.
We see that Anakin and Dooku are going to fight off again, so Anakin's power will have doubled in, what, a week? It looks like there's a lot of great action, and of course, Death Watch is returning as well.
Sounds very exciting. We have to hunt that one down. Now, the preview that I saw was the preview on StarWars.com, which is about 60 seconds to 90 seconds of next week's episode, which showed four prisoners being led in by the Quarren leaders, Anakin, Padme, Ackbar, and Jar Jar. And they're telling Rip and the Quarren leader that they're not going to give in. They're not going to give them what they want. And he seems to think that he has the way to make them talk because he says, if I remember right, he says, rack them to a couple droids that open up and turn into basically torture racks. And he hooks Jar Jar and Padme up to these. And meanwhile, a couple of racks of electric eels come out of the floor. And that's kind of where they leave it. So we get a big torture scene next week, apparently.
Oh, wow. So did I hear you correctly that you said a couple of the droids actually turn into torture racks?
Yeah, there's like a couple droids. They're kind of like round or like kind of like balls or spheres. And they open up. They split in the middle and open up, and they've got little arms that grab onto Jar Jar and Padme's wrists. All right, that's going to do it for us this week. Be sure to tune in next week to hear us talk about Prisoners.
Thanks, Dan. See you next time.
Happy to be here. I'm going to be back next week, right?
Yes, absolutely. All four of us will be back again next week.
We'll talk to you then.
See you next week.
Thank you for listening to Republic Forces Radio Network. Remember, we want your thoughts on the next episode of the Clone Wars series. You can leave us a voicemail at 415-508-JEDI every week from the time the new episode airs, and voicemails received by 1 a.m. Sunday morning may be included in our next episode. You can find our reviews of previous Clone Wars episodes, as well as our summer series reviewing the classic droid cartoon series, at our website, www.republicforces.com. And be sure to listen to our other Star Wars podcast, Star Wars Action News, covering all aspects of Star Wars collecting, from figures to high-end collectibles to Star Wars Band-Aids. Republic Forces Radio Network is hosted by Jerry, Arnie, Dan, Jen, Berent, and Nathan P. Butler of StarWarsFanWorks.com. Republic Forces Radio Network, RepublicForces.com, and Star Wars Action News are not affiliated with Lucasfilm or any other official Star Wars-related company. Star Wars and all the Star Wars universe contains are copyright and trademarked Lucasfilm Limited, and no infringement is intended. Republic Forces Radio Network is a production of Venganza Media Incorporated, copyright 2011, all rights reserved.
No, I like to kind of go over the audio again and listen for what would be kind of a fun... Not right now.
Okay.
Oh, what was that? Was that an explosion?
I heard that too. I didn't know what the hell it was.
What was that?
Yeah. I didn't
Barrett,
hear anything.
Are you there?
Barrett, did the Lakers win again?
What's that?
Did you guys hear that?
Yes. What the hell
yes.
was that?
Yes.
That's Coco, my pit bull.
It sounded like something got flushed.
It did. It sounded like Ferris Bueller's coughs when he was using the synthesizer.
So, what did she bark at?
We don't know, Barrett. We're not there with you. We don't know.
No, I mean, when you heard it when I was talking, what was I saying?
Just repeat your last sentence.
I think that might be.
I don't know what I'm saying
with
half the time. What's that? With a lot of tradition. Oh God. Sorry.
Is that Arnie calling you and telling you to speed it up?
No, that's my son calling from the next room. But it was
your phone rings worse than is better than knocking on the door.
So, God, I hope you're gonna be able to edit this. So I'll just end it right now. What's that? I wish Nathan was here.
Poor Barrett.
What's that? Well, that was a fabulous half an hour discussion.
I've learned about biology.
There are a couple that breathe water and air, but there's like only like maybe a couple of genus groups that do. I'm going to take my nerd hat off since it's ruining things.
You're actually just astounding me. I'm amazed. I'm learning so much. And I'm not being sarcastic in the least. I seriously mean that.
And what are the two, Jen? Why don't you go ahead and just finish it off?
Well, there's actually,
what are the two?
You really want to know? No.
What's that? Well, this has been fun and educational and inappropriate all at the same time. I'm not really sure how we do that, but we are good.
What's that? I thought Artie was going to say, I'm glad I'm not there with you and you're saying this, I'd punch you in the face. I thought you were going to say that.
Yes. Our live show at C6 is going to be very interesting.
If I'm getting punched in the face, it's going to be very, very interesting.
Is that going to be one of the events at the Swan Party?
Yous are people gonna sue?
We get a dunk tank. We get a dunk tank for the party. Each one of the hosts just go up there and the dunk tank and get the stuff at us.
What's that?